and comes over and gets a towel and says, I need to wipe off all these future babies.
Welcome to Sincast, presented by CinemaSins.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Sincast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined as always by the voice of CinemaSins, Jeremy Scott.
Yowza.
Yowza. And from Music Video Sins, Barrett Scher.
Zoom. Hey, remember when Axl Rose used to end all of the songs with something like, yowza? Like, he would go on his vocal tangents. He's like, yowza. And well, he would always outlast everybody else.
That's how half of their songs got made, was him doing something fucked up and weird. And then I'm like, oh, let's turn that into a song. You guys got good and pissed off about something lately?
I feel like I'm taking crazy pills!
I'm as mad as hell!
You've never seen me very upset.
You can. I was only going out of obligation because Barrett pointed at me, but then I realized he might as well have been pointing at you.
Because... I was pointing at anybody.
Yeah. past few weeks, I've been doing more Uber Eats than normal. Part of it is because I'm very tired of what I prepare for myself every day. Another part of it is just supporting restaurants and supporting the people out there who are, you know, delivering food to us and everything. And so I started doing it, and I like the service pretty well. From actual drivers, I think there's one time where they delivered food to my neighbor and then, you know, didn't deliver it to me personally or whatever. But there's this one weird thing that I can't seem to get a success rate on, and I don't know whose problem it is. I don't know if it's the restaurant. Don't know if it's the driver. Don't know if it's both. Sometimes when I'm ordering an Uber Eats, I'm like, I'd like to have a dessert with this meal. I don't do it all the time, but I'd like to have a dessert. For some reason, I have about a 30% success rate in getting that dessert.
30% success?
Yes.
Wow.
It's not good. It's not good. So I don't understand what the deal is. Like, I understand that maybe the restaurant gets the order and they're like, well, we'll make the dessert later because it's, you know, usually cold. And then they just end up not doing it. And the Uber driver comes in and like sees the bag for the person that they're delivering for. And they just take it and just go. Don't even bother to see if there's other items. Or, you know, it could be one of those things where I don't know. I don't know what the deal is, but I just never get it. I don't understand. Now, to Uber Eats credit, if you say I didn't get an item, you just say I didn't get it and it refunds you. I mean, that's right now that's touch and go because I refunded something last night and I still haven't seen anything that proves that I've gotten my money back yet on it. These desserts are usually like really, really expensive too, considering what they're, you know, $6-7 for a fucking brownie or some shit. I don't know what the deal is. I don't know what the deal is there. Why am I not getting it? Whose fault is it? And if there's an issue where you can't prepare the dessert for some reason because it's cold or because you just weren't thinking about it at the time or whatever, why even bother offering the dessert? I think there's some restaurants that just go ahead and say sold out on all their dessert stuff because they know that it's going to be impossible for them to send it. But yeah, man, I have zero. I don't know what the deal is. 0%. You know, it's every once in a while I get it and that's it.
What if your Uber Eats driver is Uber eating your dessert?
That is a possibility as well.
Because I'll be honest, assholes. I'll be honest. I have not yet trusted an Uber Eats service or any of them, any food delivery service other than the standard pizza or Jimmy John's, then because those, I think I've said this before, because those people are employees of the food maker. So if something is wrong, I can go to the food maker Domino's mm-hmm. and say, hey, your driver fucked up my pizza. Whereas if it's Uber Eats, I always feel like I could go to Uber Eats and say, well, I didn't get my pizza or it's fucked up. But then is it the driver's fault or did the pizza place fuck it up? And I just feel like there's too many variables there.
Yeah.
And also maybe they eat your stuff.
Yeah, for sure. There's definitely too many cooks in the kitchen when it comes to getting you your food. There's no doubt about that.
You really think they're eating your shit? No. No, nobody's eating their shit.
No, I don't think that. But
no, I'm talking to Jeremy.
I think the worst in people. I've seen one too many of those viral, I'm sure, exception to the rule things of like, there was one of like a dude leaning out a window in New York, and down in the alley, there was an Uber Eats driver who was literally taking bites out of every dish and then putting the packages back together. Yeah, see?
Oh.
I'm sure that's the exception to the rule. I mean it, but I'm too terrified. I don't trust people. And but also, your story reminded me of something. Back when you and I were working at Hollywood 27, I lived over in Antioch. Mm-hmm. I used to eat very bad food, and I used to eat fast food, and I used to go mm-hmm. to Arby's. And
yeah.
Listen, everyone who sells French fries should sell cheese dipping sauce for those French fries. they do it at Culver's, and they do it at Arby's. Only every time I would go through the drive-thru and order, you know, two sandwiches of curly fries and a cheese dipping sauce, I'd get home, and I wouldn't get the fucking cheese dipping sauce.
Yeah.
And so I called. After the third time this happened, I called and talked to the manager. And he was like, I'm really sorry. If you come on down here, I'll give you, you know, your entire meal, you know, again with the cheese sauce. And I was like, I appreciate that, but I don't want to drive all the way back down to you. I already made that trip. If you're going to put a price tag next to an item on your menu board and I order it, it ought to be in the bag. It's not something mm-hmm. that you should forget, like ketchup or something, right? You like, charge me money for it. And ever since then, after that, I always got the cheese. I feel like the message was received, and he went and put a sticky note somewhere and said, don't forget the cheese sauce. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes I might have been a little angrier than I should have been, but, you know, Jesus.
You know what you did? You changed the world. Mm-hmm. You know, the word hero is thrown out there a little too much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
But, you know, sometimes you got to call it what it is.
That's right.
I'm sure there are other people that went through there after me who ordered and got their cheese sauce and they never knew who to thank. Mm-hmm. It me.
I mean, yes, I totally understand Jeremy's reticence to use services like these because exactly what he's talking about. At the same time, I'm not right now going to go to a restaurant and just, you know, I could, but I'm not going to go to a restaurant and pick up an order or anything like that for now. I mean, in a couple of weeks I might, but it's just one of those things. And I just recently started this. I've probably done it now. It's probably been a month, but like, you know, spaced, it started off slow and then it was, you know, I started doing it a lot recently, but yeah, it's just, it comes down to the point where you're just like, all right, I won't order dessert anymore. I understand. I get that you can't do it for some reason. There's something that's a mental block somewhere in this whole thing. Anyway, yeah, it's nothing that I'm like super angry about. I just want to know why is it so hard to get those. So,
my knowledge of the restaurant industry is basically limited to food programming and a few buddies of mine that are chefs or food service operators. But if I recall, like there is a sequence to firing the dishes and dessert. Of course, is always last, mm-hmm. and I think it probably is exactly what you mentioned. Like they make the main or they make the appetizer first. Everything hot and ready to go is packaged, and then either they forget later on the ticket because they're used to firing it at a certain point in the meal for each table, or it could be that they just pick it up and get it off before they actually fire it.
Yeah.
But, that is interesting. I'd never really thought about that because I don't typically get desserts, but it should be over 30%.
Yeah, I mean, on the, and yeah. and the other reason that it's not the best type of service to use is there are so many service fees and so many different little additional costs that they throw in there. And I tip well. It's just that then they throw in that, you know, $1.49 for a service fee, and then there's a delivery fee if they're busy. There's all sorts of little things that they throw in that, you know, let's face it, the delivery fee is a bunch of bullshit that tries to dissuade you from actually using their service, because they're like, there's some restaurants that are, or it's not, it may not be the restaurant, it's Uber that's making this delivery fee the price. Like, there's some that are like $14.95 for a delivery fee. Or
the fuck? Like that.
And I'm like, you're basically saying don't go to this restaurant, right?
Yeah, I mean, no kidding. That's a whole extra meal.
Nobody's going to pay that. So you're basically just saying, and don't go here.
You know, there are so many restaurants now, at least in my area, are doing these quick takeout racks, right? And my wife and I will do like Jersey Mike's probably once a week. And they had a table just inside the door. Got all the bags with the names and the receipts. And there are three or four places that do this. Jersey Mike's is just one example. And we tip well because we understand the risk they're taking by going to work every day. But I was asking my wife yesterday, do you think they know us? Like, you think they see our name every week? And I'm sure we tip more than the average person. You know, do you think we're like digital regulars at Jersey Mike's? Like, they don't know what we look like, but they know our names, and like, they make our sandwiches extra good or something. I don't know.
I guarantee they. That was interesting. Because particularly Jersey Mike's, they have usually like a pretty close knit. Like, I always see the same people working there every time I go over there. And it used to piss me off because they would want to chat every time I went in there, because I also go in about once a week. And I'm like, dude, I'm here for a sandwich. I don't need to know about the Seahawks or like fucking how your grandmother's doing. I hope she's doing well. This guy is a big Seahawks fan. Like,
you know, there was one thing that upset me about Jersey Mike's. I used to go to the one that was close to Hollywood 27 all the time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I used to get this one sandwich, and I would get them to put it on the grill and heat it up and everything. I guess it was ostensibly a cold sandwich that I would get on and put it on the grill. There was one day I walked in and I was like, and I could have put it on the grill. And they said, oh no, we can't do that anymore.
Fuck.
And I was like, why can't you do it anymore? And they were said something, I guess they're trying to imply that it fucks their ovens up or it fucks something up or something like that. And I was like, okay, I guess I just won't come here anymore. That particular sandwich, you want what you want. And that it being grilled that way was always like the big, selling point for that. Even though the sandwich itself is good cold, it's so much better hot. And, and it's like, well, why would you have an edict like that where the customer, you know, isn't right ever, you know, like, oh, well, you know, it fucks up or what, you know, it doesn't.
Yeah, like, man, at Jersey Mike's at my old house, it was not a happy place, by the way. No one working there was happy. And my wife likes to get cucumbers and green onion or green pepper on the sandwich. Now, they have that. It's just not on display at the station. You can see where they make your sandwich. It's over in the case with the meat. But almost every time I would ask for it, the worker would be like, and then walk over to the cold. Like, oh, I need to take three extra steps, you selfish bastard. Don't put it in the case and offer it if you're not going to give it to me.
Come on, B-Mix.
This has turned into like all food related. I'm going to pivot my rant. I was going to rant about one thing, but I blew that wad in the pre-show, and I'm going to talk about something else that's bothering me a little bit. And I'm going to say outright, The guy in question here is no hero. All right. So it when the Masters starts every year, they used to have Gary Player and Jack Nicklaus and Arnold Palmer would all tee off ceremonially. They're all old. The ball doesn't go very far. It's not about that. It's a ceremony thing. The Masters is all about ceremony. And lately they've been having, I think Arnold Palmer died, right?
Yep. He did.
Yeah. And so Lee Elder, who was the first black member of the Masters or of Augusta National, has been taking his place. And he this year is too old to even swing. He was in a wheelchair and he stood up while the chairman of the Masters read a nice little thing about Lee Elder and his ceremonial tee shot, which was metaphorical. And in one of the shots, Gary Player's son holds up a sleeve of golf balls like this, about breast level. And it's apparently a company he's affiliated with, Encore Golf Balls or something. And the headlines for a few days that I saw, I'm a very big fan of golf, if you haven't figured out. I watch a lot of fucking golf. The headlines were all, did Gary Player's son try to do viral marketing with the golf ball sleeve? That was the headline, and I saw it in several places. This morning, the headline is, Gary Player's son has been banished from Augusta National for life. Now, this is not a good person, all right? This is a guy who 2 years ago was busted for a scam where he was trying to take money from people, claiming he had housing for them during the Masters tournament, but he didn't. I haven't dove into that. I'm just saying even his brother came out today and said, this dude's embarrassing to our family. Mm-hmm. The timing is not good, right? When we're honoring the first black member of Augusta National, that is not the time to hold up a sleeve of golf balls and advertise. I get it. I just want to point out the entire fucking tournament is populated with people who are advertising with their hats and their balls and their clubs and their bags and their shirts, and we have no problem with it. So there's a little hypocrisy here. You know, even in the ceremony, even in the big finish, you know, Matsuyama's wearing a Srixon hat, and I guarantee you that that company's executives were overjoyed how much screen time their logo got. In a very commercial dollars and cents kind of way. And I just think, I've been to the Masters. I think the ceremonial stuff is awesome and it largely makes for a cool event. But I think in many ways, they're just a little too stuffy for their own fucking good. And you ban that guy for life if you want. He had bad timing, but you turn a blind eye to all kinds of on-camera marketing, stealth or otherwise. And, you know, it's just a little... just a little shady to me is all.
Well, and not exactly related to your rant about the golf balls, but you're talking about how the Masters are stuffy and everything. Like they have control over everything about how that event gets broadcast and everything. And it makes it confusing and weird for a lot of people who want to watch it. Like it's like, oh, well, we've got it on Paramount Plus for the morning, but it'll be on CBS in the afternoon. And you know, for a fact, CBS wants to play that whole thing. They're not sitting there going, boy, I really wish we could play, you know, Young and the Restless again or whatever. You know, they're not sitting there doing that. I don't understand. I've never understood that kind of control. Like, it's almost like they're doing it just because they can, and it's not really have anything to do with their product whatsoever or anything. It's just that they love having that power to do that. Because there is that makes no sense. You're going to lose money by doing that.
They don't even care. You remember when that prominent lawyer woman 10 years ago or so tried to cancel the Masters because they didn't have a female member at Augusta National.
Right.
And she went after the sponsors. And so before even any sponsors could pull out, Augusta National was just like, fuck it, we'll do it without sponsors. And they did.
Yeah.
They don't need money, man. They don't need any money.
They don't need money, but I'm sure that there are a few people on their board who are like, God damn it. Why do we have to be like this because of three assholes over here who want to do this?
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy. That's interesting. I hadn't heard any of that stuff. So that was brand new information. Did not realize Gary Player even had a son, but
he's got two at least, and one is embarrassed of the other.
I have a happy rant, and it'll be quick because it's almost a recommend, but I wanted to put it in rants because I think it goes a little bit deeper. My family and I have been watching a show called Black Lightning recently. I don't hear this show being talked about. Certainly not as much as the other CW DC shows like Arrow and Flash and Supergirl and this Lois and Clark inversion, Superman and Lois. And I think it's because they usually have crossover events, right? They have the Crisis on Infinite Earths and things like that. Black Lightning is in season 4, I believe, right now. And my son has been wanting to watch it for years, but not years, but for a long time. And my wife said that it was too violent for him. So I was like, oh, let's all watch it as a family and we'll see. Man, the show is, it's not addictive in a regular superhero show way. It's addictive because it shows a completely different side of these superhero stories. It's almost an entirely African-American cast. It is a superhero that I didn't know anything about, Black Lightning, and his daughters both have super powers. One is thunder and one is lightning. Jefferson Pierce is the main guy that's Black Lightning. He is the principal of the school, and he is out to subvert all the stereotypes of young, angry black men. There is drug use. There is gang violence. There's some heavy shit in here. The younger daughter smokes weed a lot. But it's not a thing. It's not a thing on that show. Like she'll make a crack like, man, I need to smoke less weed. And it's not like the show is impugning her for doing it. She's a regular 17-year-old and regular 17-year-olds smoke weed. And so it's a very different look on this sort of societal impact. And as it dovetails into the superhero stuff. And I like it, man. I like it when shows like this, serial stuff like this, goes deeper than the average superhero drama. Now, to its credit, Arrow did this when it came to drug addiction, when it came to relationships, when it came to family. It was very complicated. It wasn't just a regular shoot 'em up, you know, fire an arrow into his neck type of show. And Black Lightning is exactly like that, except it's also a standalone. It doesn't rely on cheap crossovers. Supergirl doesn't fly in and be like, hey, BL, you want some help? And then like fucking and like fly off. And he's like, thanks, Supergirl. No, it's on its own time. It's also got one of the best villains ever. This guy, Marvin Jones III, who is albino, but terrifying. He plays a character called Tobias Whale. And anyway, I'd like to recommend this and rant about how shows like these are trying to subvert superhero tropes and story tropes and really showing you a black perspective from the ground up. It's awesome. So yeah, that's my happy rant. I've been trying to talk about that show for a long time and I always forget, but we're still watching it, man. It's on Netflix and then CW airing live. So good stuff.
All right. Awesome.
Right on. Right on.
It becomes like, you know, a prelude to our recommends and warns and everything.
A
like
pre-recommend a warn.
Yeah, exactly. Our main topic today is, which director would you like to sit down and watch a movie with? Who do you think might give you some insight and be a great conversationalist during that movie and like get, you know, get really down deep into all your favorite movies and everything. And I don't know what our criteria is. I think we all have maybe some different criteria for what
I think we do have slightly different criteria. Yeah.
Yeah. For who we'd want to watch a movie with and why. So it'll be an interesting, exercise, I think. So, who wants to start us off?
Well, I dreamt this up. And so, I'll go first. And my criteria was, more trying to match a modern director with something stylistically from the past that I would like their insight on because of a loose connection in tone or style. So Edgar Wright, to begin with, is a very unique filmmaker, and he has a very unique style. A lot of it is in editing, movement of the camera. It's very whimsical, manic at times, comic. And so, you know, my first answer would be, I would like to sit down with Edgar Wright and watch maybe something like Buster Keaton or Charlie Chaplin. The kind of stuff that I would maybe guess he would cite as an influence. I don't really know. I haven't read too much about him. I'm just going on his style. And I feel like even if it's not something that was an influence, I would like to hear his input. I would like to see the moments that he calls out that aren't necessarily the most famous ones you've seen, where something is being done that I didn't notice. And so that was sort of my criteria, and I guess we can round robin it a bit, but that was my first answer. I'd like to see what he has to say about that kind of stuff.
That'd be awesome.
I mean, that would be fascinating. I think any of these like cinephile type guys would be great to sit down with. That's the reason why I put Tarantino at the top. Now, as an actual like guest at your house watching a movie, you may not actually ever get to see the movie because he's going to be sitting there talking about all these different things that are in this movie, man, and blah, blah, blah. One thing about Tarantino that I've always like, this is one of those questions that you can veer off into a whole bunch of other different things. I've always wanted to see Tarantino do a popular type movie. Like what would, when there was talks about Tarantino doing a Star Trek, I was like, fuck yeah, let's see what his Star Trek looks like. Mm-hmm. You know? And you know, that never got off the ground, and I don't think it'll ever will, but you know, and as a movie guest, I want to hear what he has to say about movies that are popular, well known, because every time you hear about Tarantino, he's like going off on some 1957, you know, exploitation flick or something like that, and just sitting there just going, all right, yeah, totally, I can see why that totally was an influence on Pulp Fiction somehow. I want to be able to watch something like Jurassic Park with Quentin Tarantino.
Oh yeah.
Oh man. Yeah.
And I want him to be able to dissect that movie. Maybe he hates that movie. I doubt it, but like maybe he hates it. But I just want to hear what he has to say during a big production. Anytime he mentions big movies, it's always in reference to his own work a lot of times. So it's like I was at Pulp Fiction and Forrest Gump, you know, was going to be the movie that year, blah, blah, blah. And he doesn't say anything about Forrest Gump whatsoever, which is what I want to hear.
That would be hilarious.
Right. I want to hear his comments on that. I mean, just hearing John Waters talk about Forrest Gump, I mean, it was as simple as, you know, him saying like, He was saying, man, I there's a lot of people I know who's like, I just can't watch your movies. They're so this and that or whatever. And he's like, well, that's perfectly fine. That's what happened when I started watching Forrest Gump, and I pressed stop 15 minutes into it. So hearing what Tarantino has to say about these kind of movies and everything, I think would be valuable, would be very fun. And especially since I know Tarantino likes the weed, he would, you know, we could smoke some weed, watch Jurassic Park together. It doesn't have to be Jurassic Park, but I think that would be an excellent movie to watch with him.
Sure.
And have deep conversations about film while we're smoking weed.
I love it.
Speaking of weed, noted stoner, Jordan Peele would be so much fun to watch a movie with. This immediately came to mind because he's so smart. He's so smart about filmmaking and his comedy. Every time I watch a Key and Peele skit, which he wrote a lot of those, I don't know what the percentages were, but he wrote a lot of them. There's always some different layer to it. Like there's always a stinger at the end of the skits that take it in a completely different direction, which I totally appreciate. It, you know, it's setting you up for one thing, and then all of a sudden, like, it moves to something else. And he's so smart about that that I would love to watch, like, a satire with him. Classic satire like Dr. Strangelove, or more modern satire like Death of Stalin, I think would be hilarious to watch with him, because you can tell he gets things. I bet he's got a terrific laugh. And I bet he'd just be super fun and super, especially with something like Dr. Strangelove, where he'd be like, yes, here's what Kubrick did that I would like to do. Or, you know, this is how you set up a joke. This is how you do a proper pratfall, that kind of thing. I think that would just be awesome to just sit down with him for 2-3 hours and shoot the shit about some smart, funny movies. So that's sure. my pick.
I always thought that, you know, sitting next to somebody who's really, really has made a living making comedies, you know, it's always it's one of those. I don't know. It's some sort of ism. I can't remember what the word is right now, but to say that it a joke is not funny when you explain it and everything. However, explaining jokes is very interesting, which is one thing that people leave out of that whole thing. It's like, yes, it will not make you laugh if somebody has to go, okay, well, here's the basis for this and blah, 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 blah. But people who really think about comedy knows that there's a whole bunch of different nuances to it that make certain things funny. And that's why it was, you know, it was real fun. We didn't get to go in depth, but when the Cracked people came out here, I know that those people sit there and think about what makes something funny. Sometimes it's just taking a word out of something, or sometimes it's just like a, you know, like, let's, you know, there's a lot of different little nuances to all that. So, like, watching comedies with a comedy person would be amazing.
Yeah. It's like totally diagramming a sentence to me. Like, I was always fascinated in diagramming sentences, because it you figured out what clause goes where and how they interact and all that stuff. That's the same thing about diving into the birth of a joke, or the guts of a joke is, yeah, okay, it probably makes the joke you're studying unfunny, but it also breaks down why it's funny, and you can use that for different things later on. And that does appeal to me. I totally agree.
You guys know the Shazam director, is it David Sandberg? He has done a couple of video essays. Of course, we referenced one in our Sins video for Shazam, because he had done an imitation of our voice in explaining why the kids were wearing coats, among other things. Well, he put another one out recently, just a day or two ago. It was outstanding, about setups and oners, and when you can take a one shot and turn it into your second setup. And he used What Lies Beneath, and talked about how Zemeckis is really good at taking these one shots that go through a house and then turn and settle, and they end up being, you know, the face shot over the shoulder of one character, and then there's only one other setup to hear. That guy knows his shit, and I think it's fascinating that I feel like there are two kinds of directors, right? People like that, people who are diagramming the sentence, so to speak, when they're directing. I'm going to put this here because of this reason and this reason, and it's going to look good because of this. And then I feel like there's another subset of directors who are like, I'm going to put the camera here because that's where I want it.
They were told in film school, you need to start with a wide shot, then you need to have a medium shot, then you need to do your close-ups, and then that's what they do. Yep. And then they move on.
Yeah. So I have at least one more. We're going to do another round.
Sure.
I am choosing David Ayer. Now, he is most recently known for Suicide Squad and Bright, which were not very well received. Prior to that, he directed In this order, Harsh Times, which is a Christian Bale movie I really like. Street Kings, which has Neo in it.
Which is the same movie.
And, as Neo and, in it. End of Watch. and then a movie called Sabotage. And then Fury, that Brad Pitt, Shia LaBeouf tank movie.
Oh, he, also, he directed he
also,
that?
Yes, and he also wrote Training Day, Dark Blue, and SWAT. So I feel like his lane is gritty cop crime stuff, right? For the most part, that's where even Suicide Squad and Bright even could be classified in that genre. And so I want to sit down and watch something that is from that genre before his time. So my first thoughts, not going too far back, was Copland. And then I thought if we go back further, maybe Bad Lieutenant or maybe even French Connection would be something that would be interesting
Bad
to
Lieutenant.
Get.
That'd be crazy.
I just feel like, you know, he's drawn to these, you know, these morally, you know, gray or dark cop hero characters and that world and what that does to being a, you know, what that does to a person being a cop and, you know, where you, every day your life is on the line, at least in End of Watch, it felt that way. So I would like to see, you know, a movie like, I think maybe The French Connection would be the pick ultimately. And just see what, again, you know, I think I have my own cliche favorite moments or insights. I want to hear what somebody with knowledge and experience in making movies, you know, has to say about the moments I overlook in something like The French Connection.
That's true. But also, it would be awesome to hear his feedback on the car chase, like how to position the cameras and like how to get the angles, how fast to go in the car, that kind of thing. That would be fucking dope.
Well, and especially since they didn't have any permits to do that scene. they just did it. Man. And you could throw the Dirty Harry movies in there.
It would
definitely be fun to pick his brain on all those for sure. And see which ones were the ones that really got him into that sort of like, this is what I want to do when I make movies too. Have you guys ever seen I think it's basically a long commercial, that Martin Scorsese did, in 2007 called The Key to Reserva, where he is emulating a Hitchcock film. I would recommend this, by the way. I'm sure you can just find it online. No problem. The Key to Reserva, it starts off with him, talking to somebody who I think is supposed to be a film historian or something like that. And he's like, this is some long lost script that Hitchcock wanted to do, and we're going to do it here. And it, you know, it ends up just being a big long commercial for like some, I think it's wine or something like that. however, Scorsese goes through this thing and has a lot of like, I mean, it is shot like a Hitchcock movie all the way through, very well imagined and everything. And it's got all sorts of like, inside jokes and things to other Hitchcock movies throughout the thing. So watching a movie with Martin Scorsese, especially Hitchcock films, a lot of these older classics that I know that's what Scorsese sort of bases his whole thing on, because he's always been that, you know, kind of guy. I think he was one of the people who brought, was the Red Shoes? Is that what it was called? He was one of the people who came, who restored that movie, The Red Shoes, which is a really good movie, by the way. And he's always been a champion of this. But watching Hitchcock films with Scorsese would be incredible, especially considering all the work that you see that in this The Key to Reserva, where he's emulating things. And a lot of times you're sitting there watching it and you go, how do you know to shoot the movie in this particular way to make it look so Hitchcocky?
Hitchcocky.
There's so many like little shots and they're like, yeah, that's exactly how Hitchcock would have done this shit.
Yeah.
And knowing the exact depth of field and like where to put the camera and what the actors are doing and everything. It's funny watching The Key to Reserva in 2007, I didn't know who Michael Stuhlbarg was, really. Didn't know who Christopher Denham was. You know, seeing – and Simon Baker is in this, too.
Watching it, and I watched
it recently because a friend of mine emailed it to me. I was like, oh, yeah, I totally forgot about that. But, yeah, I think that would be fun, Scorsese and Hitchcock films.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Good call.
That's a student of film, not content.
That's right.
Student of phlegm.
That's right. Student of phlegm. Phlegm? I tell you what, man, I'd like to have an excellent action director watch an excellent action movie. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about this, you know, female directors specifically that were excellent at action sequences. And Kathryn Bigelow was the first one that popped into my mind.
Yes.
You cannot get more tense action, except maybe being in the real life one, but the Osama bin Laden raid in Zero Dark Thirty. Mm-hmm. You can't get more intense, dramatic action than 90% of the Hurt Locker.
Oh my God. No kidding.
Jesus.
So I think it would be outstanding to watch something like John Wick 3 in particular was one of my favorite movie going experiences of all time because I was with you guys and our friend Patrick, and to watch that movie and those stunts and those action sequences with a director that does thoughtful action and to see if she gets the same delight as I do watching that whole thing. Mm-hmm. And she could break down like, I can't believe they used that or they went with that angle or they did that. Man, that would be so fucking cool because you would get the enjoyment of watching the movie, but then you would get the insight on like, you know, this is a pretty spectacular stunt or this stunt actually looks a little harder than it is. Maybe it's just like, you know, all that horse kicking shit is CGI anyway. So that's all bullshit. But I think that'd be fun as hell. And Kathryn Bigelow should be talked about as, you know, the world's best action directors. She just puts a lot more thought into her films, specifically Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty, than you would get with standard typical action movies.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Katie Biggs.
All right, everybody, it's time to talk about BetterHelp.
Yeah, it is. Yes, it is. It's BetterHelp time, baby. I keep hearing about people. Sorry, it actually makes me a little emotional. I keep hearing about people that have listened to us or have watched a few videos where we've had BetterHelp integrations, and it takes them sometimes a long time, but they end up signing up and they end up thanking us and they end up thanking, you know, the service and everything. And that touches me deeply because I know you hear us talk about this service quite a bit, but it's because we appreciate it and we support it. And we are all the way behind it. I use it. A lot of us use it. So anybody that does get this message, it gets through and you're like, all right, I'm just going to do it right now. Thank you guys for hearing us. And I guarantee you, you can get something out of it, especially given what you put into it. BetterHelp is a great service, folks.
Listen, I think one of the things that's hard for me individually is that sometimes people misunderstand our video content, right? Or don't like us, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. That's not easy for me. It's one of the things that drives my anxiety is that I've always wanted everybody to like me. So naturally, I started a YouTube channel called Everything Wrong With. You know, this has been such a good match at BetterHelp and our podcast because we've always been very open about mental health and therapy and it's always been an important issue to us even before BetterHelp came along. And, you know, we like to advertise products that we use. And, you know, the more we use this product, the more value we see. And I think all the stuff that we deal with online, I'm not the only one that gets some of that. You know, it's all worth it to me if one person starts going to therapy, because that means we will have impacted one person's life for the better. And that is a feeling that likes on a video could never bring. And so when we do get these notes from people that Barrett's talking about, we take it to heart. It makes us tear up. It means a lot. It really does, because I know how much it can help. And the fact that BetterHelp offers you a way to do therapy your way from home, if you want to do on video, if you want to do text, you have options, and you don't have to get in your car and drive anywhere. And it's just been a really good fit, and we're really big fans.
BetterHelp, HELP.com/Sincast gets you 10% off your first month. Jeremy said it best, man. It is a virtual counseling service that employs licensed professional counselors. Mine could not be better and could not have helped me more since I've been using this. So go to BetterHelp.com/Sincast and thank us later. Or don't thank us at all, but do it. Just sign up.
Well, let's go to our recommends and warns then.
Totes amazeballs.
They're great.
It won the Academy Award.
Oh, for what?
For best movie ever made.
Ooh, anyone burning? Anyone burning?
I'm gonna go ahead and warn a movie that Jeremy, a couple of nights ago, brought up.
Oh no.
Yes. The movie is called Endings Beginnings. It's one of those, you know, typical, you know, Jeremy, it has its charms, I will say,
two in particular.
That's right. It's a typical, you know, Jeremy movie that he somehow, some way saw this movie, like found it. I don't know how. It's on HBO Max. you watch movies like this. This is one of those movies where you're like, how did they get people to want to make this movie? how did they pitch this? Like, if I'm an executive and they're like, well, this is about this woman who breaks up with her boyfriend and then moves in with her sister and her husband. And she wants to try to find a job in the art community, and she needs to be alone. But the problem is she runs into both Sebastian Stan and Jamie Dornan at this party. And they just so happen to be friends. But we never once see them together. Actually, maybe one scene we see them together talking in this movie. And basically it's going to ruin her plan that she's just going to be by herself and, you know, try to find this art job that she just so desperately wants and blah, blah, blah. I feel like this movie, really, really like, it loses its own, like, I don't know it seems like there's a more interesting, avenue they could have picked on this, because the one really good like thing it touches on in this is that when she's going around looking for jobs, she puts on her resume, I was here at this place for 6 months. And that's a huge red flag to these places that are trying to hire her and everything. By the end of this movie, we find out that the reason she was there for only 6 months was because there was a dude at a party who may or may not have raped her, and she doesn't know. And she had to leave because that dude was working there. And then, you know, and she actually, you know, eventually goes and calls HR and says, you know, I worked at this place for 6 months and I wanted to stay longer, but I couldn't. And here's why. That story is the most important part of your story, I feel like. Instead, they made it about, you know, okay, well, I'll fuck Sebastian Stan, and oh no, wait, I'll fuck Jamie Dornan now, and oh, who's my real boy? Who's my boyfriend out of this and all that? And there's even and since this is a Jeremy movie, I'll go ahead and just spoil the whole thing.
Awesome.
She ends up getting pregnant and not knowing which guy it is.
Yeah.
And there's a whole sort of like, you know, there's a whole like story about, you know, like, well, you know, should she have an abortion or whatever? And she's like, I'm going to have this kid. And then, you know, Sebastian Stan is like, do you know whose baby it is? And she goes, it's mine. She's mine. She's my baby. Which is a cool line, but like, it seems like it's lost the plot. Like, I don't feel like this is the story that they should have pursued in this whole thing. If they wanted to make an erotic drama, I don't know if it made it to that, really. Like, it's, you know what I mean? Like, it's got nudity in it, but it's not like, it's not, I don't know. There's a scene, this may get cut out. this may get cut out. This is so fucking sickening to me. Jamie Dornan, after like just pile driving her in the bed, you can see that they've made a, he makes a concerted effort to pull out, and he goes, oh, I'm sorry about that. And then he comes over and gets a towel and says, I need to wipe off all these future babies.
That's not good.
It feels like to me that there was a real story here, but they didn't know where to go with that, which to me, I felt like that was the most important thing, was the reason why she left her older boyfriend that she broke up with, the reason why she left with him, the reason why she tried to move, the reason why she did all this stuff. Like, that seems like to be the more important detail in this. That romance thing just doesn't make, it's not devastating that she's dating both of them at the same time. There's nothing to it where you're like, oh my God, she's really like, you know, this is bad for their friendship. Cause you don't give a shit about their friendship. It doesn't matter which guy she's with at any time, because it's like, neither of them are good, really. Again, how does this movie get made? That's the thing I want to know. I want to know what the pitch is that a studio goes, yes, this is what we will make, because this is going to do wonders for us for some reason. Like, there's so many movies out there, so many interesting movies out there that don't get made because it's not certain. It doesn't check certain boxes. How does this movie check the boxes? That's what I want to know. The movies that do get made, that they somehow checked some sort of boxes. Like, it's gotta be like who, you know, again, we go back to this whole thing. Some person had an idea and had a friend who's a producer, and a producer was like, do you think we could maybe conjure up $10 million for this movie? Yeah, sure. Fuck it. I don't who cares? $10 million.
Is this new?
2019, yeah. I think is when it came out. So I thank Jeremy for the heads up about this movie. And I ended up watching it because I had trouble sleeping the other night. So I was just like, all right, I'll just go ahead and watch this bullshit. That's what was going through my head the whole time. I was like, how did this movie get me?
Oh, my God.
Jeremy, be honest. Did you watch the entire thing?
I'm sure I did, but I wasn't all there.
You've seen it three times.
I'm sure it was on the TV for its duration, but I was doing other shit too here on the computer. So,
right, I see. Mm-hmm. I've got a Rekha Warn that I'll make brief because it's a fairly old movie. It's a 2003 movie, and it was prompted by a Reddit post. I've been spending a little more time on the subreddit, the CinemaSins subreddit, recently, and I forgot how awesome that community is. Very cool. Yeah, we've got like 25,000 people subscribed to it now. So there was a question on there, dual question about Rick and Morty and the Mexico trilogy. The Mexico trilogy being Robert Rodriguez's kind of long-running series that includes El Mariachi, Desperado, and Once Upon a Time in Mexico. And it got me thinking about these because I haven't watched those movies in a long time. So I remember my favorite of them being the last one. So I went back and watched that. I do remember El Mariachi. El Mariachi famously was shot for dirt cheap, I think for like $15 mm-hmm. or something like that. Yep. It's
one of those that always goes across the map. They say this and then they say that. Yeah. $7,000 was the figure that I heard for the longest time, but who knows?
Yeah, exactly. And it was all Robert Rodriguez's friends. It wasn't, it weren't professional actors or anything like that, but pretty good movie. It's a pretty, especially for how indie it is. You know, this was the early 90s where you'd see people like, Tarantino making his first stuff and Kevin Smith making his first stuff. And it was interesting. Desperado got a lot of press back in the day. I mean, it was huge. And I never really understood why. Yes, it was a little gonzo with all the weaponry and everything. Yes, Antonio Banderas is super sexy. Yes, Salma Hayek is super sexy. But, like, it was way overblown in my mind. It was very pulpy. And so Once Upon a Time in Mexico came out really at the height of Johnny Depp's popularity. This is post Pirates of the Caribbean, the first one. He's in all of this stuff. This is long before any allegations of abuse and stuff like that. And he is essentially the star of this movie. It's not Antonio Banderas as El Mariachi anymore. Salma Hayek's dead. And, basically, there's a little Mickey Rourke in there. There's a little other guys in there. But Johnny Depp is basically this movie. And at the time, his performance pissed me off a little bit because it was so over the top. It was so over the top. He's got this thing where he orders a pork dish in every restaurant in this town in Mexico. And when he gets the one that's perfect, he goes back and kills the chef. And I'm like, and he tells Cheech Marin, he's like, Johnny Depp, this pork dish is so good. I'm going to go back and I'm going to kill that guy. And it's just like, what the fuck? And he's a CIA agent and it's just all over.
Well, and there's that over the top line. I think it's to Danny Trejo where he's like, are you a Mexican or a Mexican?
That's right. Yes. going back and kind of being more removed from the performance of the day, because as we've seen, Johnny Depp's performances have gotten even more bizarre over the years, especially Tim Burton stuff. It's a fun movie. It's not great. If you watch it through the Planet Terror lens, another Robert Rodriguez film that was in the Grindhouse double feature, and you take it for what it is, you'll enjoy it a lot more. Don't go in expecting Sergio Leone or that kind of thing, because it ain't that. Even though I think he's trying to do the good, the bad, and the ugly. It's a little overcomplicated. It's a little pulpy, but it is fun. It is fun. I would recommend it. It's fun. It's fun.
I remember. So I saw Desperado first. Even though I have read about El Mariachi. And when I watched El Mariachi, I remember thinking, oh, it's the same movie.
It's like Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2, right?
Yeah. And I only saw that the once. I think I saw Desperado again once, and I know I saw Once Upon a Time at least once. But I, like you, I haven't gone back to him in forever. I don't know that I will, but I'm intrigued to at least see a few minutes of this Johnny Depp performance just because of how you talked about it.
It's fascinating. And again, when you go back to it, having seen Depp just kind of like go really weird over the last few years, it seems muted in comparison. It seems charming in comparison. And I have to say, I am not a huge Robert Rodriguez fan. I like more about like what he's trying to do than I actually like what he does. It's almost like Justin Timberlake for me. Like I don't love his music, but I love everything about him. This is probably my favorite movie from him. Maybe from Dust Till Dawn.
I'm trying to think
from Dust Till Dawn.
I'm trying to think if there's a movie aside from Dust Till Dawn that I really really like.
Do you like the Spy Kids?
No. The first Spy Kids is okay, I guess. I didn't like the other two.
What?
And what?
I sneezed and said they're terrible. Sorry.
Yeah.
That should be less subtle.
And you know, you have Alita Battle Angel, which is okay.
Oh, that is good. Yeah.
I don't like Sin City at all. I never saw the Machete full length.
Those are feature. Fun. Yeah.
Alita, that was good. I'll pick that one.
Yeah. And he did The Faculty, which I haven't seen in forever.
I loved it when it came out, though.
It's the same movie as Teaching Mrs. Tingle and Disturbing Behavior and like every late 90s movie.
But this one has a synthetic street drug inside of hollowed out ink pens. And I think that makes it totally different.
Is that where they're aliens? Yeah. They're aliens, right?
Yeah, well, they're like body snatcher aliens. Yeah.
Exactly what Barrett was saying. It's just like all those other fucking movies that came out at that time. It might be the best one though. That's
actually,
out of that
curve. Probably so. So maybe I do his stuff better, more than I thought.
There's a great John Stewart role in that movie.
There is.
Yep.
I'm going to start with a warn. I'm going to go with a warn. This is a 2012 movie called The Words. Ever heard of it? Me neither.
No. I have heard of it.
Shit.
In fact, when you wrote the name down, I thought for sure I may have even seen it. But I read the synopsis on this thing, and I was like, no, I did not see
it. For the record, don't try reading the Wikipedia synopsis. It's 95 paragraphs long. This movie.
I don't never understand it.
I don't either, man. I just need three paragraphs. Give me the gist.
And yet, when people write these long Wikipedia things in the plot synopsis and everything, they sometimes miss really important things. Like sometimes I'll be watching a movie and I'm like, wait a minute, why are they doing this? And you go to the Wikipedia thing, you're like, oh, surely they wrote every detail there. And it's like, they just like gloss over it as worse than the movie does.
Yeah. Saving Private Ryan has like 12 words for the
scene. I'm going to give you the cast here real quick, the main hitters, because you will, I think, be saying like with Chris's movie, how did this get made? Dennis Quaid, Jeremy Irons, Bradley Cooper, Zoe Saldana, Michael McKean, J.K. Simmons, Olivia Wilde.
Wow.
Damn.
This is a movie about a guy. Okay, I'm just going to give you the plot. This movie's boring and sucky, and I watched out of pure, unadulterated, morbid curiosity. It opens with Dennis Quaid reading to a lecture hall from his own book, a bestseller. All right? But as he reads, it switches to Bradley Cooper, who is playing the character in this book. All right? There's really no reason for this narrative structure except for the stupid ending, which I'll ruin.
Nice.
So Bradley Cooper is a struggling writer, and he gets a job at a publishing house so that he can, you know, pitch books, but he's like a mail clerk. But apparently that's a thing in the movie that people do. You get a job on the lowest end of the totem pole at a publishing house if you're a writer, and eventually you can slip your manuscript to somebody. Seems like long odds to me, and maybe a good way to lose your job, but apparently this is how it's done. But he keeps getting rejected every time he submits his stuff because he's no good. He's literally, I'm assuming, just a terrible writer, but he tortures himself over his writing. So he marries his girlfriend, Zoe Saldana, and they go on their honeymoon to Paris. And they happen to love antiquing in Paris, as one does. So they end up in this antique store, and he picks up, I swear to God, the scene is, cuts to them inside the store, and he picks up an old leather briefcase, and she walks up and says, I'm buying it for you. I'm like, what the fuck is happening? So they go back home, and he's hating himself for being a shitty writer, and as one does, goes digging through this briefcase, maybe there's a secret compartment behind the fold. There is. There's a whole manuscript of a book in there that somebody wrote and left there and never published. And it's an awesome book. It's amazing. Mm. And so what does Bradley Cooper decide to do? He decides to type this book up word for word on his computer just to feel what it's like to write a bestseller. Okay. By retyping. He's literally just typing something somebody else wrote because he thinks, and this is an important plot point, because he wants to feel what it's like to write something good, even though he's not writing. It makes no fucking sense at all. So he files it away and goes back to his shitty life delivering mail and getting rejected. Only one day, his wife goes snooping on the laptop. And what does she find? A book. She knows he's been writing. He's never shown her anything. She's going to read it because that's what you do. She, of course, loves it because it's an awesome book. And then she pushes her husband, Bradley Cooper. You have to submit this. You have to submit this. You have to submit this. And Bradley Cooper, being a fame whore, decides to submit it as his own book. And, of course, the publishers love it. They want to publish it ASAP. And it goes on to be a bestseller. And he's a famous writer now. And one day he's on a bench at the park. And Jeremy Irons sits down. And through... one of the longest scenes in the history of cinema.
Has he met Jeremy Irons at this point? Or no. Is Jeremy Irons? No.
Well, we have. The viewer has.
Jeremy Irons sits down.
The viewer has. Because Jeremy Irons plays both the writer of the original book and plays the flashback of the character in the original book when Bradley Cooper is reading it. So we've met him that way, but Bradley Cooper has not. And in one of the longest scenes in history, he says, basically, I'm going to tell you a story about a guy who wrote an awesome book and the pissant who's found it and published it as his own. And Bradley Cooper's like, oh, no, now I'm going to be tortured for 30 minutes of the movie because I have guilt. it's like Limitless, only with limits. he eventually gets so tortured, he tells his wife, and Jeremy Irons just wants to punish him. He doesn't want credit. He doesn't want money. He won't let Bradley Cooper do anything for him. He just wants to punish him for his soul. And the story is that Jeremy Irons, when he was younger in the war, met and married a French lady in Paris, and they had a kid, but their kid died. And that caused them to break up. And then he wrote this beautiful book. And when she read it after he sent it to her, she was so moved, she decided to get back together with him and took the train to meet him. And they reunited, and she left the fucking briefcase on the train, and it was gone forever. Gone forever, I tells you. Gone forever. Finally, Bradley Cooper tells his publisher, I didn't write this book. Of course, the publisher's worried about a lawsuit. He finally convinces Jeremy Irons to help him, you know, work together to try and reprint the book with his name on it, get him credit, what have you. Jeremy Irons dies. Remember Dennis Quaid?
Yeah, I remember.
So Dennis Quaid is then basically confronted by Olivia Wilde, who's in the audience. Yeah. And she's like, I think your book is true and you stole it from some other old guy who actually wrote it. And they never really say yes or no. The end. Don't waste your time, people. Yeah.
It's interesting. This movie on the IMDb, and I know ratings are, a thing that we can't quite condense into. Well, is this a good movie or not? But 75,000 votes on this movie. It's got a 7.0. So people do like this.
You know what? I've seen this.
Oh no! Oh yeah. No.
As you were describing this plot and the actors, I was like, I've totally seen this movie, and I watched it with my wife probably a couple of years ago, and I felt the same way. It's just so long and boring.
It's a 24 on Rotten Tomatoes, so just, you know, take that.
Yeah, that's IMDb such a weird discrepancy. Like, that's such a weird discrepancy. Yeah. Like, even the audience didn't like it when it came out. I don't
know. There's just a lot of attractive people in there between Olivia Wilde and Bradley Cooper and Zoe Saldana.
Well, and to Jeremy Irons. just sort of go a long way to saying that this movie might not be good. Barrett just said it was so long, and it's an hour and 42
minutes. Oh, God. Well, I'll tell you what. I am terrible about judging those because I felt like Once Upon a Time in Mexico was fucking long, but it's just over 100 minutes. I'm like, Jesus Christ.
Sometimes movies are like that, man. So even enjoyable movies sometimes. Yep. You're like, God, this is taking forever. And then some movies are 3 hours and you're just like, whoa, where did the time
How go? Long was so, The Words again?
Hour and 42.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, it's not long at all. With credits, it's probably an hour and 36.
I tell you what, no, you're absolutely right about that scene in particular. That one where Jeremy Irons sits next to him and just decides to torture him. And
You're legitimately going, is he ever going to tell him who he is? God damn, this is taking forever.
All right. I'm going to recommend a very, very, very light documentary called The Last Blockbuster. I don't know if you guys
have seen it. I haven't. I want to, though. I'm all about this kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a nostalgia trip, and it's interesting to see. There's this one Blockbuster that's in Bend, Oregon. I was kind of interested in this being the last Blockbuster, quote unquote, because a year or two ago, I remember there being talk about there being a couple left in Alaska. John Oliver did a thing where he sent a bunch of Russell Crowe memorabilia to one of them. to help them out or whatever. And in this documentary, it's like, nope, even all those have closed at this point. Now it's just this one in Bend, Oregon. And it goes through the history of Blockbuster, how it started, what decisions they had to make at the time. And there's a bit of an argument as to whether Blockbuster really did, start going out of business because they weren't doing, Netflix things, or trying to compete with Netflix, or if it was just because of a lot of other financial things that were happening around that time. I think some of the people who worked at who worked in the corporate Blockbuster seemed to blame the financial crisis in 2009 for all this. And or 2008, I guess. But it's really focused on this one store in Bend, Oregon. And it shows the people who worked there. It's this one woman who's basically like worked at this one Blockbuster for 15 to 20 years or something like that. I don't know how long it's been, maybe longer, maybe 25. There's people who still, come out and rent videos. You know, it's a weird thing to think about in this day and age. There's people who, but of course, now that, that this one store has become such a media darling, there's people coming from all over to this one Blockbuster. But it's a lot of celebrities and everything talking about what they used to do with their trips to Blockbuster and how they would plan a date night and how they would do this and that, talking to workers and all the things that they would do when they were working in a Blockbuster. You got Kevin Smith in here. You got Joseph Gordon-Levitt's in here. Not Joseph Gordon-Levitt. It's not him.
Shane West.
Devin Sawa. Iona Skye. Brian Posehn. Doug Benson. Doug Benson is pretty well featured in this. Paul Scheer, Jamie Kennedy, Lloyd Kaufman, who runs Troma, has a really fun rant about Blockbuster in this. He does not like Blockbuster one bit, so it's a fun thing to see what he says about the whole Blockbuster thing. But Adam Brody is in this. And Lauren Lapkus is the narrator and shows up a couple of times. But anyway, it's an hour and 26 minutes. It's a light documentary. If you grew up in the age of Blockbuster in the days where you had to actually drive to a place and get a physical cassette and to watch your movies and everything, it's fun. I think some people go a little too goddamn overboard about their nostalgia about these video cassettes, though. there's one guy who's like, He's like, oh, it was so fun to close that case and hear that snap and everything. And it's like, okay, look, we've gone too far.
Yeah.
We've gone too far with this nostalgia when we're talking about how great it was, like when I had an orgasm closing the case of my video cassette, like, because we all know that didn't happen. So, anyway, it's good. I would recommend it.
I worked at Blockbuster for a while.
How long did you work there?
Yeah,
I worked at three different ones. In college, I worked at the one in Kankakee, Illinois, for roughly 8 days. The second time I tried to switch with somebody else so I could go to a concert, I was fired. unceremoniously, because I didn't care enough about the job, even though it was fucking Counting Crows, man. I had to go. And then
Mr. Jones and me.
I worked at a Blockbuster down in Fort Oglethorpe, Georgia, which is near Chattanooga. Mm-hmm. And there was a guy there who had a scam that he would break PlayStations, and then the company would have to order a new one because we rented out PlayStations. And for whatever reason at the time, the policy was throw that broken shit out in the dumpster. And then he would go collect all the broken PlayStations from the dumpster and take them to the local guy, fix-it man, electronics shop, and say, make me a whole working PlayStation out of all these parts. It's quite the scam. He did it three times. I went to Inglewood in East Nashville. When I first moved there, before I worked at Hollywood 27, I worked at that Blockbuster for probably 6 months.
Nice, nice. Doing only appropriate things in that block.
I was assistant manager. So, you know, I had keys to places.
I had two diametrically opposite experiences at my local Blockbuster in Green Hills. The first one was where my older cousin was working there, and he would give me all my shit for free. I'd just get up there and he'd just like, thank you, sir, you know, and basically, you know, go along your way, which was awesome because I could, you know, I was underage. And at that time, Blockbuster was pretty hard on carding you for rated R movies, which is fucked up to me now. But, you know, it was the case then. So I could get whatever the fuck I wanted. Obviously, they didn't have any porno, but you could get close. You could get Flesh Gordon or something like that out of there. And then so he left. I keep going back to my local Blockbuster. I'm 16, something like that. Can't rent rated R movies. So I borrowed my buddy's account. And sometimes I didn't have his card on me. So they could look it up and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They're like, what's the last name? And it just happened to be his last name was Schaefernacher. Nice. And and so they were like, can you spell it? And I was like,
no.
I don't know.
This is supposed to be my last name. I should be able to rattle this shit off in no time. And I butchered it. I was like S7Q3, something like that. And they're like,
that's so awesome.
So you've seen that Simpsons, right, Barrett? The one where Homer is he sent a package to Mr. Burns that he doesn't want him to see, and so he goes to the post office and dresses up, puts the mustache on and a top hat and shit like that.
Looks and like he Mr. goes, Peanut.
Hello. Yeah. Yeah. He's like, hello, I believe you have a package for me. It's under Mr. Burns. He goes, okay, okay, Mr. Burns, what's your first name? I don't know.
Man, I was completely hosed in that moment. I was like, you got me.
That's amazing. Man, in college when I worked at a three screen, I had the sweetest get-up set up with the Family Video store manager. Family Video is a Blockbuster competitor that was in many ways superior. We didn't jerk each other off, no. I would give him free movies at the theater, and he would give me free rentals at the video store. And that was a win-win, baby.
And so, and they had porn, right?
I don't know. I wasn't renting that at that point.
Family Video?
I think they did.
I was going to a Christian university. I wasn't trying to, like, I mean, I would have watched it, but no, we were, this was like the, I'm just saying, Josh and I would rent movies every week. We'd get three movies every weekend for free and then just binge. Almost always bad movies. Like, let's find the first movie Ben Affleck's ever been in. And we found it. It's awful.
Isn't it School Ties?
Well, maybe that's the first one he was ever in. It's a, I think it was called Glory Days with a Z.
That sounds right.
Wow.
Let's see. That may not have been his first. 1995. I'm right about the title. Hey, French Stewart is in this. This movie was awful. A lot of people are in that.
He's in Field of Dreams, uncredited.
Wow.
Yeah, it's not his first, because he, yeah, like stuff like that. And then he was apparently on, in School Ties before that. Days to Confuse.
He was a child actor. He was in a movie in 1981.
Huh. Yeah, this is the same year he made Mallrats. So. But anyway, that was one of the movies we rented that we were like, that was terrible. Let's do it again.
All right, everybody. It's time to talk about Clear VPN.
Clear VPN, folks. Okay, I'm going to be honest with you. I've never used a VPN before. I knew what it was. But like I never took advantage of what a VPN is because I just kind of do my normal internet stuff. So I downloaded Clear VPN, C-L-E-A-R, VPN, and it's got this wonderful interface to it. It's got this this thing that comes up, and it's got shortcuts to different things. So you go to a VPN, which essentially kind of puts you in a different place virtually. And it's got little shortcuts where you can watch Oscar movies. You can watch Netflix and other streaming services from different countries, which has different content available. You can watch sports on different platforms internationally. It's very, very cool, man. And so now I am a VPN convert. And I got to tell you, Clear VPN is smooth. It's fast. It's effortless. It's secure. You can hide your IP address. You can access any content, secure your online interactions. And of course, our audience, movie fans, you can go to the shortcuts for Netflix and HBO and be able to look at the premieres and new content there. They've even got one for Best Picture nominees for the Oscar. So now that you've heard me talk about it and gush about it and lose myself over it, you know you want it. You know you want it. Go to my.clearvpn.com/sincast. Here's what you're going to get, folks. You can get 25% off a premium account. Get you a premium account. That gives you the whole kit and caboodle, right? And they've got this cool thing where you can do a monthly, or you can do a yearly, or you can do a two-yearly. But it's 25% off my.clearvpn.com/sincast. It's the only VPN that you need. Go ahead and try it. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on my Rekha Warren because we've talked about this movie before, but I did watch Moulin Rouge again, or I should say I watched 40% of Moulin Rouge, and then I got a fucking headache because that movie is so loud and so manic. I cannot take it. I can't.
It's not wrong.
Take it. I can't.
Not wrong.
I can't. Baz Luhrmann is just not my kind of guy. All right. I think The Great Gatsby is my favorite movie from him.
Oh, you take that.
And that's saying something. I can't take Romeo plus Juliet. I can't take Moulin Rouge. I just can't do it. I said a Rekha Warren because there is something. He's definitely just said, I'm going to fucking go for it. And I respect that. But I can't hang. I can't hang with that, man. It's like taking meth and then snorting some Adderall off a hooker's ass or something. It's just too much. It's too much.
Does it have to be off the hooker's ass?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Oddly, I know exactly what that feels like.
Oh, shit.
Anyway.
I may be in the minority here because I love this movie. And I know what you're talking about because it is one of those crazily edited, especially super lavish and yelly type movies. Baz Luhrmann really liked him some John Leguizamo for some reason. And Leguizamo is one of those performers who will just go all out for you. And even as annoying as it gets, you know, he'll do that. I mean, he plays that, you know, Toulouse-Lautrec, you know, whatever. And it's just, but they just keeps, he does a lot of like hyper editing and everything like that. But I've always really liked this movie. And I haven't seen it probably in a couple of years, maybe 2 or 3 years now, but, every time I pick it back up, I get right back into it. It's one of those movies
that
it can do no wrong now. Every time I watch it, I'm like, yep, I like this scene. I like this scene. I like this scene. I like all that stuff. So
my wife came in yesterday and, Talented Mr. Ripley was on. And whenever we order food, I mute the TV and then we focus on the computer when we place an order. And she walked in and she goes, "You watch this movie a lot." And I said, "Every time I see this movie on the guide, I stop and watch it. Every fucking time. It's just become one of those movies for me."
I understand.
All right, I'm going to make a recommend because I'm very rarely lately been full-throated in a positive direction, and this is not a new movie, and I've even talked about and praised this movie before, but I watched it again recently and I can't say enough good things about it. It is 2011's Warrior with Joel Edgerton, Tom Hardy, and Nick Nolte as the primary, and Frank Grillo's in there a lot too. This is directed by Gavin O'Connor, who may be a name you don't recognize, but he has now directed two of the best sports movies of all time with Warrior and Miracle, the hockey film with
Interesting.
Kurt Russell. He also directed The Accountant with Ben Affleck and The Way Back with Ben Affleck. He is not a nobody. And Warrior is about mixed martial arts and two brothers from completely different points in their lives, both dealing with trauma from childhood in different ways, and both end up contestants. Both have completely different fighting styles. And I'll be honest, and please don't take offense at this, I could give a rat's ass about mixed martial arts in general. I could give a rat's ass about boxing. I have a good friend who's really into both, and so I've seen plenty of both. But I don't care. I don't care about it, and you're not going to reel me into your movie by making it about mixed martial arts. What reeled me into this movie was somebody, I think it was Dicer or Chris, saying, "No, that's an A+, you should watch it." And so I did. I don't really want to spoil too much of the plot, even though it's a 10-year-old movie, because I really think the journey of each brother is kind of the point. And you don't have that amazing ending in the ring if you don't sort of go on their journeys with them. But suffice to say, their father was an asshole, Nick Nolte, when they were kids. One of them left, the other one didn't. Neither one of them had it really great being apart from each other. And this movie's about healing pain, man. It's not as much about mixed martial arts as it is dealing with the trauma in your life and dealing with your own decisions. Tom Hardy's character has different turns as both hero and bad person, depending on how you view his actions in the past. Via the flashbacks. I don't know if you guys, have you seen this, Barrett?
Yeah. Okay. They got all swole for this, right? Like both of them.
Oh yeah.
Edgerton and Hardy got like fucking ripped.
They're genuinely beefed up for this. And I honestly think you could put, I don't want to name names, but you could put two, you know, C-level actors in these roles and make this movie. And it would probably be solid, decent, but it's the acting of these two guys that really pulls you in. And Tom Hardy hardly says anything the whole movie. Like most of his performance is silent, quiet. Anyway, I can't say enough about it. I really think everyone would dig it. And I hope you will watch it. I recommend 2 thumbs up.
It's an 8.2 on the IMDb, by the way, this movie.
Wow.
And a 83 on Rotten Tomatoes and available on Hulu.
Yeah, I haven't seen it since the Thursday night before it came out. Watching it at Hollywood 27. Need to rewatch it. But I do remember afterwards thinking, man, that was a fucking good movie right there. Yeah.
What if they put Jai Courtney
what if?
And the other guy that looks like Jai Courtney and Tom Hardy?
The best.
They should.
I'll tell you what, who steals this movie in one scene is Kevin Dunn. He plays the principal at the school where Joel Edgerton works. And in the beginning of the movie, Joel Edgerton is doing underground mixed martial arts for extra money because he can't make enough as a teacher. And he gets found out and the school fires him. Kevin Dunn fires him. But by the end of the movie, Kevin Dunn is like the dad in That Thing You Do. He's come full circle and he's watching the fight on TV and he's jumping up and down going, "He did it! He did it! Oh my God, he did it!" And it's heartwarming as fuck.
To recap, Barrett Recawarned, Once Upon a Time in Mexico, the Robert Rodriguez movie. It's a part of his Mexico trilogy. He also Recawarned Moulin Rouge. I piggybacked a recommend on Moulin Rouge.
But,
this point, you either know about Moulin Rouge or you don't. You're an asshole. Jeremy Warned, The Words, a Bradley Cooper Thieves, Jeremy Irons book movie. And he recommended Warrior, a really, really good movie that I need to rewatch myself. I warned Endings, Beginnings, Shailene Woodley.
And Future Babies.
Future Babies. She says it's creepy right after that. And I'm like, yeah, nobody ever would say that in the ever. Jesus. And I recommended the last blockbuster, the documentary about the last blockbuster rental place in the entire United States in Bend, Oregon.
I'm gonna watch that
documentary about that.
All right, let's start with this one. So questions.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I'm listening.
I always admire when actors take a role that requires him or her to play a terrible person, particularly when the actor is asked to humanize that person. What is a movie role that you admire an actor for taking? This person's answer would be Michael Fassbender in 12 Years a Slave. God, that is a great example. He is a terrible character in that movie.
For sure. Samuel L. Jackson in Django Unchained is one of those characters. I think it's easy to do the villainous stuff, but this is a testament to Tarantino as well. You can see how much of a facade it is, but also how much it is, it's a part of his daily life to be this way in Django Unchained and everything, and be that, what would you call his character? Like an Uncle Tom character, right? Like, to play that kind of character is tough, especially considering, how people, read into your characters and they think you are that and everything on the street and that type of thing. That's the type of thing I worry about when people play villains like this, is that somebody is like, Robin Williams in Insomnia.
Yeah.
You could equally apply that to 1 Hour Photo, because he did that in the same year. Robin Williams had done a lot of dramas before, but I don't know if he'd ever been the bad guy in anything before this, and he could have continued being the good guy or being the comedy guy or whatever. But I think it was this is something most actors at the top of their game won't do when they're known for being the good guy so many times. I don't know why. I mean, I feel like a lot of these people, like Tom Hanks and Will Smith and everybody, could be a bad guy and we wouldn't flinch. It's not like we think any less of them or anything, but maybe they think that same way about the people on the street and stuff like that.
Well, I'll tell you what, people still yell bitch at Aaron Paul every time they see him. And I just read yesterday that people come up to Sebastian Stan all the time and chant the phrase that's supposed to like hypnotize him. but I just thought of one that wasn't on my list that I'm going to put, and I hope Barrett didn't write it down, but it's, honestly, everyone should be commended for playing characters in this movie, because this movie shouldn't have been made, but it's Stanley Tucci in The Lovely Bones.
oh God. It's like,
hey, Stanley, we've got a movie about a dead girl's ghost who's kind of like watching her still living family. She was kidnapped, and well, we don't go into much detail about what happened to her, but it was a creepy guy who kept her bracelet and sweats all the time. We want you to play that guy. What do you think? And, you know, I can't watch that movie. I watched it once. I won't watch it again, but I do commend him for taking the role.
Should not have been made. It's like, that's a book that was written to be a book forever because of the way it is structured. It's all narration.
Yeah.
Throughout. It's this girl's ghost talking about all this stuff all throughout the whole book.
Yep.
So like when you turn it into something that's, and it's not, then it turns into something like super creepy and gross. And
well, they offered that role to Mark Wahlberg and he said no. And so they gave him the other role.
Yeah.
Another one I thought of is for a different reason is Steven Seagal in Executive Decision. Because this is at the height of his Seagalness. He'd made Above the Law, Hard to Kill, Merc for Death, Out for Justice, Under Siege, On Deadly Ground, Under Siege 2, and then he makes a movie where he dies in the first 10 minutes. Now tell me how... that had to be an ego pill to swallow, right? Because the next movie he makes is he's back at it. It's The Glimmer Man, and then he makes Fire Down Below and Exit Wounds and The Patriot, and he was the star of these movies. And Executive Decision sets him up to be the star of this crew that's coming to rescue the plane, and then he's dead. And
although I don't know if it really does, because the trailers showed that part where he's like,
they did,
where he ejects himself away from Kurt Russell you're not going to make it. You are. And they did it right at the end of the trailer.
I still think it's big of him to take that role at that point in his career.
No, I agree totally to do that. And it also, you know, we are built to not believe what we see in a trailer like that. We expect him to just show back up in that movie by the end of it, but he doesn't. He fucking dies. He's dead.
I'm gonna piggyback on Django Unchained, and one of the most loathsome villains is Calvin Candy, Leo DiCaprio's character in Django Unchained.
Yeah,
and it's weird because it's been so giffenized. You had my attention, or no, you had my interest, and now you have my attention. And like, you know, him raising the glass and everything. That character is absolutely irredeemable and loathsome. The stuff that he does is just absolutely unforgivable from his intro until the way he treats Kerry Washington's character. It is hideous, and I'm glad he's dead. To paraphrase Jack Nicholson, I'm glad you're dead. But man, but
I'm trying to figure out if he'd ever been a villain before this movie. I'm trying to think.
Certainly not on this level. You've got to be.
But I don't know if he's ever been a. I don't think he's ever been a bad guy. Period. Until this,
probably not. Probably not.
Because and then you could say he kind of was, I believe, later in Wolf of Wall Street, even though he's still the main character in that movie. So it's hard to tell whether or not the movie thinks he's a bad guy. I think he is, but but I don't think he's ever been that villain like that before this. So that's another reason why it's so, like, it's brave in a way, even though, again, like I said, more actors should do this. I feel
well, I agree. And, you know, to me, he's the crux of that movie. You know, this movie is so controversial that this was Will Smith was offered this role, right, of Django.
Yeah.
And he turned it down because it was a little too raunchy and a little too controversial. So somebody as A-list as Leonardo DiCaprio taking certainly the antithesis of Django and taking that role and killing it is a commitment that God bless him. I commend him, even though that character deserves to die, and I hope he burns in hell.
Yeah, it's funny. The the Jamie Foxx, that I saw a video of him talking about what Tarantino was like as director and everything, and saying that, you know, yeah, it was one time where he had to pull me aside and kind of yell at me or whatever. He's like, we got done with a take, and he's like, Jamie, come here. And he goes to like a private room somewhere, and he's like, you come in here, you're just too cool, man. You're just like, you just drove in your Porsche, and you've like got, you know, you come in here, you know, and you're like, you're too Jamie Foxx for this. Like, we need you to be somebody else.
You're too Jamie Foxx. And I do want to mention one of my favorite villains. I know you don't love this movie or even like this movie a lot, but Philip Seymour Hoffman in Mission Impossible 3. Like, mm-hmm. his character is so built up by the time we meet him. Like, he's the most mm-hmm. ruthless person ever, and we can't find him and that kind of thing. And yeah. what he embodies is basically that bad. You know how you build up villains and, like, it turns out to be Hillary Swank or something like that, and it's like, oh, who cares? Yeah. His character...
It was Kiefer Sutherland all along.
Once he gets on the plane, and he's, by all intents and purposes, he's caught. And he's like, what's your name? And then, you know, I'm going to hurt you, and I'm going to hurt your family. And like, even when like he's held out of a plane, you're like, this guy is way too dangerous for any of this to be happening. And, oh, it's so good. He's so good. He's awesome.
You threw me out of a plane.
God, it's so good. Anyway, so that's my commendable villains.
Good call.
What actor/celebrity has the best cameo resume?
I know you guys stole the best answer.
Yeah, I think you guys have already written the best one. But going back to Samuel L. Jackson again.
Ooh.
This guy has quite a few in his resume. Now, I'm cheating a little bit because he wasn't famous when he was in Coming to America, right. But that's a cameo. Goodfellas, he's got a cameo. He is the DJ in Do the Right Thing. But then later on, we see him in Out of Sight at the very end of that movie in the wagon that George Clooney's in. He's obviously, you know, one of the best cameos of all time is at the end of Iron Man, telling him about S.H.I.E.L.D. And everything. So, he's got quite a few. And of course he's in the other guys, for a brief moment, which is, you know, one of the funniest, exits from a movie ever. So he's and there's probably some I'm not even remembering because he's in 200 something movies.
He's essentially a long cameo in Deep Blue Sea.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. It's true.
I feel like there's a couple more that are just there's
definitely a couple. Oh, he's at one Kill Bill Volume 2. He's the piano guy.
Yeah, that's right. In the church, right?
Yeah. Just before Carradine comes in with all of his mates.
His mates. You sound like you're from London.
That's right.
What you got, Jeremy?
You stole the best answer.
It's the best one.
I know, you bastard. So I'll go with Scorsese. Just because quiz show would be enough for me to argue his place on the list just from that one single cameo. He loves to cameo in his own movies, but not in ways that are quite as in your face like M. Night Shyamalan does, where he's more often like the voice or photographer in the background or the passenger in Taxi Driver. You talked about that, I think, last show. But he's in Age of Innocence. He's in The Grifter as a voice. Does a lot of voice work. He was a dispatcher in Bringing Out the Dead. And I think that's probably my preferred. I think Hitchcock did a lot of background cameos as well, whereas M. Night seems to write characters that have dialogue and don't necessarily belong in glass.
Well, Hitchcock would also try to get it out of the way in the first 5 minutes too.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Another big thing was he knew that people would start looking for the cameo, so he just started doing them in the first 5 minutes. And you're like, oh, there he is, and then you can watch the rest of the movie.
Scorsese's also a cameo as himself in Entourage.
Yeah, that's true.
He calls Vinny.
One though, where he's playing the Geritol executive and everything is clearly his best all time appearance in a Taxi Driver definitely that, but when he's like, "Ooh, what a grueling line of inquiry," and he tells the lawyer, he's like, "Hey," he tells his lawyers, "Would you please leave the room? Just take this and leave the room, please." And then he just goes and tells Rob Morrow, like, "Yeah, of course I knew all this shit was going on. That's an insult to even think that I wasn't." You know?
Mine is the best, Matt Damon.
Matt Damon.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Euro Trip. Jersey Girl. He was also in Entourage.
Most of the ones that you're thinking of are recent, because he's been in a ton of those.
That's true. Things. Happy Feet 2. He is one of the Krill with Brad Pitt, which is so crazy. Interstellar is a long cameo, but that's a cameo.
Yeah, I would say that's a cameo.
And that was a well-kept secret, too. Like, I didn't know until a couple of years later on. I knew there was a cameo, but I didn't know which one it was. Of course, Thor Ragnarok, when he's playing the acting version of Loki. he's in Deadpool 2, heavily made up as the redneck guy. Which is funny. He's credited as being Dickie Greenleaf in that movie. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
So, and then, of course, Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back and Reboot. He's a cameo. He and Ben Affleck Ben Affleck has like three cameos in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back.
He's played so many characters in the View Askew universe and everything. Same as Jason Lee shows up as a couple of characters.
Exactly. So yeah, he's the leader, man. And you gotta imagine that this dude is just so much fun to work with. Like, he just seems like a generally good guy, like a smart guy, talkative guy, easy guy to work with. And apparently doesn't have a huge ego, because he can cameo in these little things and nobody notices, like in Deadpool 2. Mm-hmm. And it's awesome. It's awesome.
I tweeted about this, but did I tell you guys about when I was watching Talented Mr. Ripley, and after he's killed Freddy and the inspector shows up and is questioning him in his apartment? The way subtitles work sometimes is when somebody's off camera, the subtitle will tell you who's speaking since you can't see them. And when Damon's character, who is Ripley, goes to change his shirt in the other room and speaks to the inspector, the subtitles call him Dickie.
Oh, and really?
I just think that's a fascinating choice to make, because he is actually impersonating Dickie in that scene. And that's a subtitle person that's paying attention, man. I thought that was fascinating.
There's a lot of weird things with subtitles. A lot of times I'm like, are you ready to reveal that yet?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The villain speaks.
Right. But it also gives you information that the movie itself never gives you, like the names of certain villains and stuff like that, where they're like, you know, Electra. Of course, it'd be Electra, you would know. But like, it just, you know, it would be a villain and you're like, oh, I didn't even know that's what they were calling this villain in this whole thing. That's going to do it for this week. Keep going to Sincast, presented by CinemaSins on Facebook. We're also on CinemaSins Twitter, Music Video Sins Twitter. We're on Discord and we're on SoundCloud. If you want to get on Discord, you can go to the Facebook and
go to the Facebook.
I'm taking the V back, God damn it. Social networking.
It'd be funny if they rebranded with all the negative press. They're like, wait, let's go back to the V Facebook.
Well, yeah, it's a lot better for us. Go to Facebook and private message me. I'll give you a link to Discord if you want to get on Discord. That's going to do it for this week. It's Chris Atkins and Jeremy Scott and Barrett Scherer. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening.
Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit CinemaSins.com.
I feel like every time, I feel like we're in this sort of group too. If we're not everything to everyone, then we're useless to them. If we don't have the exact 100% correct opinions in their opinion, then we've lost them in some way. And I don't know how to live like that. I mean, to me, I like generally give people chance after chance after chance after chance. And then if it's just a regular thing, you know, then you start going, okay, well, I don't need this person in my life. But it shouldn't even get to that point, though, because Steven's tweet wasn't even being super ignorant about anything at all. I mean, you may think he is because you've got all your knowledge and your experiences behind you, but all you have to do is say, oh, well, I think that it makes sense because blah, blah, blah. That's all you have to say. You don't have to say you're a piece of shit because you had this opinion. And people take these opinions way too seriously. People take an opinion that's like, I don't know how you can judge a person's content of character by a tweet. Like they make it seem like that's not only are they saying one thing, but there's a giant subtext of things that they're saying that's not even in there.
At the absolute worst, that's an opportunity to say, oh, interesting. Here's how I saw it.
Yeah.
And there you go.
That's all
and
you
Twitter's
have to do.
It's just never going to be that place. Yeah.
That's all you have to do.
That's all you have to do.
There's absolutely no reason to go and search for flaws in people's character and think that they're a piece of shit because they said this one thing. Like, you really are walking a tightrope these days. Look, I think the whole fight against cancel culture and all that stuff has a lot of it's being approached in bad faith in a lot of areas. But yeah. There are some things where you're sitting there going, my God, if I don't say just the right thing, then I'm going to lose hundreds of thousands of people. And with no, I had no idea that it was bad or that it was,
Like Billie Eilish posted a doodle she drew in high school of boobs and posted it to Instagram and lost 100,000 followers in a day.
That
doesn't make any sense at all.
Why?
Because it's you tell me. I'm just
so
saying.
Ridiculous.
That's how unpredictable it is. Like there's nothing.
Okay, so if I look up Billie Eilish boobs,
great. Here we go. Jesus. Yep. Why don't you look up drawing instead of boobs? Do you know how to Google?
Right.
Let me help you.
Why? I don't understand why that would. Maybe they're conservatives that liked her music and followed her, but are scared of boobs.
No idea.
God bless her. Those are great boobs.
It's pretty ridiculous.
What? Those are great boobs. Did you guys see the documentary on her?
There's too many documentaries about famous people right now.
I think it's on Apple TV, and I don't think I'm ever going to get Apple TV.
No, Apple TV can suck me. I have not. I have not.
I got it for, I think it was when we wanted to review Greyhound.
Yeah.
So I went ahead and got it. I mean, I looked at how much I pay for streaming and it's like, okay, I pay a lot of shit for cable. Okay. I understand that you're adding this on top of that. I don't pay very much for streaming at all. Streaming is fucking nothing. Streaming's nothing. You know, I mean, it's per month. You put Apple in there and you put, Amazon and Netflix and Hulu and all that. It's like,
he's right.
Paying about 40, 50 bucks for all that.
Yeah.
Not a big deal, but Apple TV, I would say it's not totally fuck this. Ted Lasso is a really good show.
Yeah. That would be the tipping point for me, I think.
And there's something about their interface. I think they play everything in like some beautiful 4K too. So like anytime I want to watch a movie, it looks better on that than it does on any other thing. I mean, Amazon, I guess, can do it too, but
Amazon's gotten weird on my end, at least.
Yeah, I don't know. Just everything looks better on that Apple TV. I don't know what's going on there. This is up the resolution or something. I don't know.
Wasn't Apple behind that Will Smith movie that just pulled out of Georgia?
Yes.
Yes.
Anton Fuqua and Apple.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. And it looked like an interesting movie, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, fuck Georgia, man. I mean, fuck the politicians in Georgia, not fuck Georgia.
Yeah. Get it inside me so that I can, you know,
get it inside me.
And you know, it's
what is that movie where dude's like, I want you inside me?
It's what? basketball.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah. So I mean, this is not nearly as important, but it reminds me of like Regal used to do things where they would be like, we want you to pull this trailer off of a movie, and you'd be just like, you're sitting there going, fucking why?
That's a pain in the ass.
yeah. I mean, and when it was 35, it was a super pain in the ass to do that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you had to snip.
Have to find it in that big, huge, I mean, it's in the center. But you go in around the center and you got to go through the trailers and, like, you know, snap a splice, find the other splice at the end and cut it, pull the trailer out, and then resplice the shit back. And you got to that in a 27-plex. You got to do that 10 or 12 times.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, fuck that, man.
And you know, it's not like you have great lighting or anything like that. So you're sitting there trying to look for it a bunch of times. You got to – and also – when everything was written on a sheet, you didn't have anything. You didn't have a computer to go to find out where these trailers are. You have to go to each sheet and go, oh, I see that it's on this one or whatever. And sometimes people would fuck the sheet up and it wouldn't be in the place where it was supposed to be. Ugh, all that. Christ. I mean, it's just a fucking nonsense. And you sit there, Regal's like, yeah, we need you to pull this trailer off. Just tell us the goddamn reason. What is that going to do to anything if you tell us, oh, we had a disagreement with this company, or we saw a dick in the trailer and we don't want anybody to see that? I mean, just tell me what the fuck it is.
The old trailer dick.
All right, everybody. Welcome to the Sincast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined as always by the voice of CinemaSins. Oh, fuck me. That's been a while.